Okay, and welcome to the follow-up interview coming in on 2 days on the heels of the last one, which was entitled A Preemptive Strike on the... What was it? Preemptive Strike on the coming breakdown, I believe was how it was phrased.
A strike against epic mental breakdown.
That's it. Epic mental breakdown. Absolutely.
Kind of
I'm still reeling
there.
And... It is, and I'm not in the best mental state because obviously both the combination of the talk and just the general state of the shock that's going on right now kind of leaves one unraveled a little bit. Now, John, I welcome you to the show tonight, and I want to ask you how you're handling this shock right now and how you're just doing there this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you for asking how I am. That's very polite of you.
I fall behind sometimes.
I'm still reeling. I'm still reeling about, but I am holding steady in the rush of the dreaming attention. You know, I've often said, and I like to say this, I don't often repeat myself, but this is something I do like to repeat. It gives me pleasure to say this, and it's also helpful because of the simplicity. The role of the Nawal is twofold. First is to define syntax, and the second is to steady the approach to the supernatural. This is what I do, as you know. And so if I'm going to steady the approach of others to the supernatural, which is the Nawal's role, then I have to be steady myself, don't I?
Yes.
So I'm holding pretty steady. Thank you for asking. And I just want to make a clarification about this title, Preemptive Strike Against Epic Mental Breakdown. I realize by suggesting that title, it's like a sensational headline you would find on an Alex Jones clip or something, you know. I should say that, there's no implication here that John Lash is having a mental breakdown. And assure you, I'm not. On the contrary, I'm having a mental breakthrough. And there is no indication whatsoever that those who engage me, hear my words, and wish to learn from me and be accessory and party to this magnificent event are going to face the threat of a mental breakdown at all. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Planetary Tantra and Kala Tantra take you into the real heart of human sanity. The one thing that we have, I think we can all agree on, is that the human species has gone largely insane in its behavior across this planet.
Mm-hmm.
The insanity of our governments, of our social institutions, the insanity of the media, the insanity of the entertainment world, you name it, everything, it's all gone bonkers. And so the path and the practice that becomes possible through interactive magic with Gaia is not only a path of exquisite beauty, pleasure, and healing, a path of wonder and delight, but it's also the return to sanity for the human species, one person at a time. And honestly, Thomas, I don't see any other way of getting back to sanity but this one.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other ways. I don't want to sound like a monopolistic, arrogant person, but this is certainly the most direct way back to sanity. So the mental breakdown of which I speak is what would happen when the sentient bodies of all human beings, let's not even talk about the rest of the animal creatures, they're also involved, and I could spend a whole hour talking about the birds and the cats and the animals who are also feeling the shock. Do you remember the tsunami in Indonesia?
Mm-hmm.
And we recall the story of how there were almost no animal deaths.
Indeed.
None of wild animals, you can be sure of that. And even almost none of domestic animals, as far as I can tell, because unless they were hampered from it, like they might have been tied or corralled, even the cows and, got out of the scene. They got out of the train before it wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is what we're doing. But I do see a wreck coming, not predictively, but I see it coming because it would be the natural effect of the shock wave that is hitting our animal bodies. It's exactly like being tasered, if you want to use a really crude example. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a violent and vulgar and horrible analogy because tasers are being used in the most disgusting way on this planet by the feds.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something like being tasered. Planetary Tantra is very high voltage. Those of you who have entered into it by now already know. Kala Tantra is super high voltage. And we are now in the rush of the dreaming attention. Let me just say a little bit. I'd like to clarify a couple of points and frame up this new intel before I go to the surreal
articulation.
Yes,
uh-huh.
The surreal revelation. I'll just say it spontaneously because this is all raw feed. I have nothing planned here. We are, you could say, if you enjoy, and this is a key word I'm going to use more and more, if you would enjoy to engage in this level of intensity and in this particular kind of practice, then I can assure you that you will know what divine alchemy is firsthand. And that everything you may have ever dreamed about it and thought about it and wondered, everything you may have supposed in magical thinking, everything you might have read in metaphysical treatises about magic and alchemy will fall away, and you will stand within the real event of divine alchemy. Remember that I assigned the syntax of divine alchemy to the perigee hits, remember?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we assigned the syntax of divine memory to
divine
the apogee
memory.
Hits. Right.
Yes.
So we move in correction between divine alchemy and divine memory. And we entered in this Matangi shift with the Matangi moon and the hit of February 11th into an escalation of divine alchemy like nothing this planet has ever seen. And all that we are asked is to participate interactively with the planetary animal mother. Call her name, make your vow to her, make your commitment to her, do the iron binding. And every single opportunity that now comes in divine alchemy will be yours. It will be yours to explore and have of your own. Tantra, Gayan Tantra, is all about power. And the power that you get from Gaya Sophia and from the Shakti cluster is actually your own power. They give you your own power.
Hmm.
This is the beauty of their gift. So I want to say that I mentioned something about the carnal embrace of the anthropos. I didn't mention something.
You went into great detail.
Right,
yes.
I instruct you, if I may use that forceful term,
mm-hmm.
to preserve and observe the syntax. When you lie in the arms of another person, now you don't have to do it naked if you don't want to, if it's more comfortable, if you just have a friend, then it can be a friend. Someone you care about and someone who shares with you the great concern for what is happening to the world and to our species, and someone who longs to love Sophia and who loves the planet, someone who is compatible to you in those ways. Just lie down on the couch with them, you know, with your clothes on. You don't have to take your clothes off. That's a more intense way to do it, but it's not, you know, imperative.
Mm-hmm.
And hold in your mind, and first form it in your mind, in your head, the syntax, because syntax is all in the synaptic corridors and channels of the brain. If I say to you, Mary had a little lamb, that's, you heard those words, and that immediately reproduces itself as a configuration in the synaptial channels of your brain. Do you know that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So we form the syntax in the brain. We say, carnal embrace of the anthropos. And then when you have that clear, it's just as clear as crystal in your mind, you bring it down and you hold it in your throat, but you don't speak it. You hold it in your throat subvocally as if you were going to say it, but you don't say it. And hold it in your throat because that grounds you. It's an NLP grounding device that I'm giving you. That grounds you. You can even put your hand on your throat if you want to, very gently. That grounds you in the reality and in the realization, in the reality of what you're doing, and in the realization that this is a ritual. This is not just two people laying down, holding each other for dear life, which in itself is wonderful in the first place.
Okay? Sure.
But it's even more wonderful than that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is the carnal embrace of the anthropos.
Mm-hmm.
It is the human being holding the other human being. It is so transpersonal.
Transpersonal, yes.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I want to point out is that I mentioned about there has to be a woman in the clinch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you exactly the reason for that. And if this doesn't shock you, you're not paying attention. It can only be done with two women or with a man and a woman. Cannot be done with two men. And why not? Well, you know, one of the archontic horrors of our times is that it has taken the variation of sexuality known as homosexuality, which is sexual love between men, which occasionally occurs in the natural order of things. You occasionally find it among animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's an occasional variant of the basic bipolarity of male-female. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
One of the horrors of the archontic exaggeration that we're in is that it has turned this, it has hyped and perverted and blown up homosexuality into something that it shouldn't be. And we find it being promoted as a political tool and even as a genocidal tool. And that is very, very evil. So I am not against the genuine and occasional occurrence of homosexual love that has existed all down through the ages between both men and both women. And it's been celebrated in some ways in beautiful terms. Sappho, Greek poetry, for instance. But I am absolutely against this aromantic and archontic exaggeration of homosexuality into such an important thing and such an important political and sociological statement. You know, that is wrong. And it even goes beyond that into the perversion of men wanting to have babies, you know, and two men want to get together and they want to have a child, and they will undergo any kind of surgical alteration of their anatomies in order to have this happen, okay?
Right.
Let me point something else to you. The archontic monsters of sexual perversion and sexual deformation who perform these would perform these operations on people and who would even say, yes, it's a great thing for our society that two men can have a child, that a man can be anatomically modified to have a child. You know, these monsters are overlooking one thing, because there is one thing that they can never do. They might, in their wildest archontic fantasies, create a situation where a man has a child. There's even been a comic movie made about that, you know, with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Mm-hmm. Schwarzenegger,
this is bad propaganda. Right? The reason why there has to be a woman in the clinch is because women do something that no man can ever do under any modification whatsoever. And that is bleed. They bleed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is why the woman is the ground, because she bleeds. And in that blood, in that menstrual discharge, there is a massive amount of iron. And so every time a woman bleeds, and even when she stops bleeding in menopause, she still has the potential to bleed. This is the primordial connection of the feminine sex with the earth and with the electromagnetic iron-bound magnetism of the planet. And we use this as our ground. That's why it has to be two women or a man and a woman. It cannot be two men. Okay?
Yes. So in a sense, it's a heavier connection, a heavier bonding that is available through the feminine aspect.
It is the essential bonding. There is no man that can bond in that way. And even these Tibetan lamas, I'm not going to go into all these distractions and details here, but even these Tibetan lamas who are now known to use, you know, the menstrual discharge of a virgin in their tantric exercises and so forth, I'm just going to blow all these guys right off the planet in what I have to tell you coming soon and make them look as ridiculous and depraved as they really are.
Great. I'm looking forward to that.
You know, even them never get to it because they don't revere the feminine in the way that they, that you must in order to perform these kind of Kala Tantra rites. These are Kala Tantra rites. So last thing I want to say before I cut to the chase is about the second attention. I mean, excuse me, about the first attention. And I want to clarify in a way that I haven't done until now to veterans, students, and crew members, and to newcomers. What I mean when I say that the planetary animal mother, who is the divine Sophia, has delivered a hit of the first attention. Tell you exactly what this is like. I can give you a banal analogy to it. Can all kind of remember when we were teenagers, you know, we're all very vulnerable and our hormones are cranking and we have a lot of this sexual longing and we have a lot of intensity, emotional intensity. We don't know, you know, all dressed up and nowhere to go. So you go to a party, right? And you walk into this room where these other teenagers and you're all kind of looking at each other and in a way, we're all very shy, but we're all like really reckless and we just want to like grope each other and get wild, but we're all really shy. And just imagine that you're standing in the corner and you look across the room. You can be, you're a boy or a girl and you look across the room and someone else looks at you. And wow, that look does it for you. You can go on that look for years. You know,
I still do that. Yeah.
Yeah. You, and we still do this with each other. This is a sign that a love is really alive and that a passion is really alive. You know, your wife of so many years, your lover comes into the room and you just look at them, you know, and pow. So you understand from this very common analogy that the look or the gaze of a living being can have power. You know? When you're in the gaze, caught in the gaze, in the look of another living being, it has power. It affects you, okay? So if you know that the look of your child into your eyes can affect you, the look of your parents or of your closest friend, imagine what the look of the planet can do for you. Imagine when she looks at you, what she can do to you just by looking at you. And the power of an aeon is called anoia, which means a projective intention. It means projective intention. Now, if we were gods, which we're not, we're animals, just like the other animals on this planet, we're not meant to be gods, we're not meant to act like gods, we're meant to play with the gods, but we're not meant to play God. Okay? If we had, if I had, John Lash, had anoia as an aeon has it, then I could walk into a room, I could look at another human being, and by locking them in my gaze, I could make them do whatever I wanted. This is what she's doing, but she's doing it out of enormous benevolence and love. She's looking at all of us. One by one, she's looking at all of the human species, and she is, through the anoia of her gaze, transmutating our bodies and our instruments right before her eyes. And all she has to do is look and convey her intention in the look, and it triggers a transmutational process in the human body and mind. And this is what these hits are. Is that clear?
Yes, it is. It's crystal clear.
And at some other time, I'll go more specifically and concretely into how I can read What is the nature of the intention? What is the nature of the event or the activity? What type of transmutation, what aspect of divine alchemy does she wish to catalyze in us by the looks that occur at these particular moments, and the nature of that, the nature of her intention and the nature of her target, if you will, is read by the position in the constellations. Okay? And the constellation of the Virgin is not just simply the biggest constellation in the sky, but it is a constellation that represents or reflects to us or displays, this is the syntax I prefer, the constellation of the Virgin displays the Virgin-born psychosomatic instrument of the human being. And so when a hit occurs at the head of the Virgin, in the throat, in the thymus, it is actually indicating that she is bringing her attention to that part of our psychosomatic makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Because the constellations are reflections of the divine components of our animal nature. And that is
And this hit of the 11th was on the thymus. On
was the high in the thymus. But it was not just an inoculation, an immunization hit, as we had previously, because there were several hits before on the thymus. And they were kind of soft. This is of a different nature. And I'm going to go now into the purpose of this hit. And that brings me around to what I have to say, and I have to get it out.
Okay.
Now, the real significance and the surreal significance.
Okay.
So, here you go.
Now, you ready to
Any
launch into it?
Any questions before I launch into this, Thomas?
If you can hold on for a second. Yeah, I would like to run one thing by you before you get into that. Just like your comments on this. I was, like I usually am, up in the mountains today. And as I've told you a few weeks ago, that I'm now studying the ascetics of Japan, of ancient Japan, you know, 1,300 years ago. And there's a character there named Enno Otsuno, and I won't go into detail on that at all, but probably the most interesting character I've ever run across in any fiction or nonfiction format. Anyway, he was one of the early magicians in Japan who lived up in the mountains and subsisted on pine needles. And I don't know what overcame me today, but I started just eating mouthful after mouthful of these soft pine needles that you find here in Japan. And it wasn't about an hour after that I did the breaking of the archontic stare exercise, you know, laying down on the ground with my head on the ground with my hands covering the back of my neck. And after about 20 minutes, when I came out of that, I sat up in Seiza and was looking out at the horizon. And I'm not making this up at all. The whole horizon was just rocking and rolling up and down like you get when you stand up too quickly sometimes. But it just wouldn't give up. It was going on for 5-6 minutes.
Right.
I wasn't sure if I was going to get down there off the mountain. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I couldn't stand up for the life of me. And I'm just wondering if that it had a total hint of the or a total touch of the supernatural about it. And I was just wondering if that is something that you would tie into this shock that's going on now.
Sure. Very, very quickly, Thomas. That is a good example of behavior that in many instances might appear to be that of a person having a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, shit, I was driving down the road and in the park, and I saw this weird guy sitting over there gobbling up big handfuls of pine needles, you know? And in some cases, people who would be doing that would be undergoing a nervous breakdown.
Uh-huh.
But you're not.
No.
You're not, because you're in a practice that will keep you out of the wreck. And in this practice, any of us, including yours truly, may at times find ourselves doing weird things or having thoughts that are overwhelming regarding nature. And this behavior, if we undertake it soberly and do not get hysterical and don't attach magical thinking to it, this behavior, such as eating these pine needles, is a symptom that you are in some respect responding to this upsurge of divine alchemy in your physical instrument. Your body is wanting you to do that. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we need to pay very close attention during the next 3 months of what our bodies want us to do. And the supreme craving and hunger that our bodies want us to do is to fall into each other's arms and hold each other tenderly for a few moments as if your life depended on it.
Mm.
Because it does. I assure you it does. The second thing I would point, second observation, is that people have been writing me about parallel experiences to yours in terms of the shakeup around them of the natural world, including the monumental planetary event of these sounds. And this is what I'm going to get to now.
Okay, yes. Wonderful.
Tell you what is the origin of these sounds.
Mm.
Okay? But I want to add that another phenomenon that people writing to me are reporting is surprising and unpredictable and anomalous interactions with birds and with insects.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see, the other sentient creatures in Gaia's matrix are also feeling the shock. And they have their own way of dealing with it. And one effect of the shock, I could go into this in great detail, but one effect of the way that these, the birds, the eagles, especially the predatory birds, and the insects, which we consider normally to be dangerous, and snakes, one of the ways that they are feeling this is that they are feeling an attraction toward us. It is attracting them toward us.
Hmm.
I want to point out, by the way, that there is enormous attractive power in this, in the rush of the dreaming attention.
Sure there is.
It makes you very, very attractive to other living beings. And so that's something that you learn to handle as well. So your short anecdote is very relevant, Thomas, and thank you for that.
Okay. Now you want to get into the big thing. This is something, are you talking about you realized 40 years ago?
Yes.
Is that what you want to get into?
Yes. Okay. Now.
Very good.
Now, first I have to make a disclaimer, and I've never done this before. I stand behind everything I say. I don't make things up metaphysically. I'm not asking you to engage in magical thinking, and I never ask you to take what I say on faith. You all know that. Now I'm going to make a disclaimer. In what I say in the remaining half hour of this talk, I could be wrong. I could be wrong, and I realize by what I'm going to say now that I open myself up to ridicule. But people can, it's difficult to ridicule John Lash, you know, because I am extremely sober, if I may say so myself. Mm-hmm. But this will definitely open me up to ridicule and open me up in some people's minds, would give a reason to discredit me. So I'm going to ask all of you who learn from what I say and who have learned to trust me as I trust you to allow me a disclaimer. I might be wrong on this, and if I am, we will go around it and continue ahead, and it won't make a difference. But if I'm right, it's going to make even a bigger difference.
Well, it's refreshing that you do that, John, because, you know, there's a lot of people out there trying to fool people, and they would never take an action like what you're doing right now. So I have complete respect for that.
I am taking a chance here, and I'm happy to do it. So here goes. In the coming months, as these perigee surges unfold, it is my intention to show you and teach you demonstrably, in a way that you can verify for yourself, the real significance of these events, of these mythological events. These mythological events have a real significance. They have a geophysical significance. And from that level, from the level of the atmosphere down through every level of animal behavior, right down into the cellular existence and the molecular life on this planet. And you can know it all. That's what it means to be a Gnosticoi, a know-it-all. You can know it all. The real significance I can teach, but there is also a surreal significance. And I can only tell it. I cannot exactly teach it. So I'm going to tell it to you now. There are sounds that have been heard on this planet since a number of years now, going all the way back to the Tao of Sam. But let's focus most recently on the ones that broke out in January, in the middle of January. You should all know, and you should all have the sobriety to scrutinize these reports, and you should understand that there are hoaxes, and that just because something is recorded doesn't mean it actually happens in nature. And even if it happens in nature, it could be faked. It could be a psyop, a military psyop, setting the human race up. It could be the testing of ELF devices to see if we can, if they can introduce the voice of God into our minds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, folks, you know, those of you who are on board here with me, done your homework in the last 10 years, you know that all these things are possible. It probably is a military aspect of it in some respects. It probably is the woodpecker, you know, the advanced use of the woodpecker ELF modulations that were broadcast from Russia into California years ago.
By the Russians,
yeah,
right.
It probably is all that. So a lot of it is faked. A lot of it is hoaxed. A lot of it is copycat bullshit by pathetic narcissists on the internet who live from getting a few hits on their websites. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Blow that all off. Blow off all the phony part and all the man-made part, and what do you have left? You have left two factors. One factor is that Gaia Sophia is awakening in a lucid dream, and she is awakening in a nightmare. And so if you imagine a woman in a bed, 23-year-old woman, because that's how old she is in cosmological terms, lying in her bed, tossing and turning, tortured by horrible images, which are the images that we see every day, the images of Muslim, 15-year-old Muslim girls raped by a platoon of GIs, images of the genocide all across this planet, of the deceit, of the lies that are perpetrated, of the horror of pedophilia, of the pretenses of kitsch, satanic black magic. All she sees is what we see in her dream. And she is tossing and turning, and she's making sounds. She's moaning. She's yelping. And you know how when you have a dream and you're in a nightmare and you're kind of half paralyzed? Like maybe mm-hmm. you're in a car and you can see that the car is going off the road, but you can't, you're paralyzed and you can't steer the car.
You can't do anything.
And you know, if someone is there present with you in the room and they are a witness to your dreaming, they hear you yelping. You yelp.
Yeah.
You know?
Yelping and whelping. Yeah.
You yelp and whelp. And you gasp because you can't really let out an enormous moan because you're in a state of semi-paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what she's going through. This is what the sentient organism of the earth is undergoing right now. And so, to some extent, these effects are sounds of the animal cries of the planetary animal mother, Pam, waking up in her nightmare. She's not waking out. Waking up in her nightmare, and she's going to become lucid. And when she becomes lucid in that nightmare, which we call human history, she is here acting on the planet just as if she were one of us. She is very close to full awakening, but she has something in her way.
Yes, that's what you are coming to.
That's right. So those are all, that is all the real significance of the sounds. The real significance of the sounds, and also some of it, is perfectly geophysical, you know. I mean, the tectonic plates around the Pacific Rim are going bonkers. These are like the mm-hmm. bulkheads of the mothership. As the mothership undertakes self-navigation, it's as if for the first time she feels the flow of the slipstream of the galactic limb, of the currents of the galactic limb. She feels it on her bow because she's alive. She's a living ship. The mothership is a living animal. She feels it on her bow. She feels the waves crashing over her deck, you see, and she's responding with an animal response by the tectonic sounds, by the release of enormous pressures inside the earth, by the enormous acceleration and intensification of these cookers, these black steamers that are at the bottom of the ocean that are sending up this volcanic gases. All of this, that's her steam engine, by the way. And then in her sails, which is the electromagnetic field, the bima, the bioelectromagnetic aura of the earth, in her sails, the sails are cracking in the wind and they're flapping in the wind. And we are actually hearing these noises. They are noises that we ought to hear because we are alive witnesses to the throes of the planetary animal mother.
Mm-hmm.
All that is the real significance of these sounds. The surreal significance is something to be understood in the context of her story. You know, I've often said, I don't have any followers. If I do, I don't want you. You know, I follow the story, and I teach you to do the same. So we follow the story. We don't follow any person. The story is the guide. The story is the master. And in this cosmological myth of the divine Sophia, there's an episode that was of extremely crucial importance. When Sophia plunged from the Pleuromic core, her massive torrent of organic light appeared like a huge plume, shape of a plume. And at first, the plume fed out. It broke through the surrounding membrane of the core, which is called the stora, or called by various names in Gnostic teachings. It's sort of like if you had an egg yolk. You know, if you have an egg yolk, it just sits there in the plate. But if you puncture the egg yolk, some of the yolk bleeds out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, her massive plume extended from the hub of the galaxy, and it shot out across the galactic limbs laterally. Now, the galactic limbs get heavier as you go out further. The actual hub of the galaxy, the galactic core, has no weight whatsoever and has no mass, because it consists of organic light. And organic light is a material, it's a substance of zero density and infinite mass. So it has no weight. But the weight, the galactic arms have weight. They're like, it's like a wheel in which the hub has no weight, but the rim of the wheel is heavy. In this case, mm-hmm. there are four different rims, which are the four galactic limbs. And so as she shot out, as her plume of organic light shot out, it had very little resistance when it was close to the galactic core. But as it went out past the first limb, the distribution of materiality in the limbs, which is mostly soot, by the way, got denser. So the density of the soot increased in the second limb, and that provided resistance to her. It was resistance because she took that material into her porosity. And so it began to load her down. So there was a progressive loading down. And she loaded down until the tip of that plume reached a region in the third galactic arm, which is where we are right now. And the tip went static. And the tip, as it were, froze. And it precipitated itself into the material of the region of the third galactic arm. And that impact on the elementary material of the third galactic arm produced the archons. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Various things happened in this. Other things happened after the production of the archons. But the main event that I want you to picture is that at a certain moment, that part of Sophia's plume of organic light that was still extending from the pleroma snipped off. It snipped off entirely. It's as if you were shooting, you know, kind of the foam that they use to put out fires, you know, mm-hmm. from one of those foam extinguishers. If you were shooting a stream of foam toward a wall, and the posterior part or the anterior part of the stream, the front part of the stream, splattered against the wall, and then at a certain moment, where the stream is coming, where the foam is coming out of the instrument, it just cuts off and it doesn't come out from the instrument anymore. It's completely detached. Well, this happened. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that event, the plume of her organic light, which was now a mass disconnected torrent, took a natural vortical form and formed a huge vortice. And so what you have at a certain key moment in the cosmological myth of Sophia is that you have a picture of the third galactic limb, which is this massive stream of plasma loaded with soot and other metal particles, iron filings, really, you know. And in the middle of this stream is floating this milky circle, this milky vortex of organic light, an extraordinary unheard of anomalous situation. And that vortex that she formed of her light, that sort of embryonic form, is the Ouroboros, the serpent eating its own tail. And it was remembered.
Yes.
Right. And it was remembered in Babylonian cosmology as Tiamat, or Tiamat.
Uh-huh.
Tiamat, who was never destroyed by Marduk and never cut in two by Marduk. That's all a bunch of macho patriarchal bullshit. Okay.
Throw
that whole myth away. But Tiamat is true. Tiamat is the name. And it's also represented in the Egyptian mythology by Nut, in this kind of like this sky goddess with the stars on her body in a circular form.
Uh-huh.
From that moment on, massive downscaling of the properties of the organic light began to occur. And this is what is called, and is, was not described in the Gnostic myths that survive, because they were destroyed, but it is described in the paraphrase of the Gnostics in Against Heresies by Irenaeus. He describes how the organic light of the goddess, her divine power, progressively, because of its high porosity, progressively sucked into itself the elements that were floating there in that area of the galactic stream and materialized. And first it materialized nickel, it materialized iron, it materialized all the foundational elements of a planet. And then it began to build around the core of that planet the shell of the organic elements, of the air, of the oxygen, of nitrogen, of argon, of the rare gases. And all of these elements were formed out of the dynamics of the materialization of the organic light of Sophia. So you follow the process. How
indeed.
The living can only come from the living, my friends.
Yes.
This planet is a living entity, and it could only have come from a higher living entity. It could not have evolved out of an abiogenetic, non-living substrate. Impossible.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The biogenetic substrate of our planet is the organic light of Sophia, and it's still here. And if you want to know how to see it, listen to the talk that Kundry and I are going to release this weekend. So, as this process unfolded, we are asked to imagine anthropomorphically that the divine Sophia, this young goddess in pleromic terms, she's only about 14 years old, in geological and geophysical terms, in the terms that we measure the scale of life, we consider the planet to be a 23-year-old girl. But in terms of the core of scientists and artists living in the Pleroma, those divine aeons, she was a very young participant in the divine experiments. And whereas the most of the Pleromic aeons were could be considered to be like senior scientists, men and women in their 60s or 70s or 80s, here was a young, prodigiously gifted, scientifically minded, artistically brilliant young girl of 14. And you try to imagine what would happen to a young girl of 14 if she was subjected to anything like this.
Yeah, she would be terrified
and coil up in fear. That's the key. This is what I'm coming to.
That she's not terrified.
No, not until a certain moment. This is such a key,
okay.
Thomas, and it's not a mistake that you said that. And I don't mean to chastise you in any way. It's just such an important distinction to make. An aeon cannot experience fear. There is no fear in the pleromic core, in the core of our galaxy. Divine beings experience no equivalent to fear. There is no such thing. It is impossible for them to feel fear. And if you think that's hard to grasp, well, just think about children. You know, if children are brought up in a certain way, they also do not feel fear. They don't feel it until the moment that something confronts them that makes them feel fear. And then they have to reckon with that experience. But it is not in the nature of a child to feel fear. Because the universe is benign. The universe is absolutely benign in every particle. But fear does happen. And what I'm telling you now, the surreal significance of these sounds comes from the way that the Aeons of Fire experienced fear. What happened was that as her organic light gradually precipitated, and this is the word, it precipitated into the material elements. And as it did so, with each different element, she felt a different emotion. With oxygen, she felt a kind of ebullience, a kind of enthusiasm. With nitrogen, she felt a kind of divine mania, a kind of infernal intensity of playfulness. And with iron and cobalt and nickel, and with the formation of these various elements, mineral elements, and then later the plant and animal elements, each of them was accompanied by a massive wave of emotion that she felt. And all of these emotions, although there was grief and sorrow, there was not fear. There was no fear until a certain moment. And that was the moment when the condensation of her organic light into a planetary body, into a planetary sphere, had reached a point where she couldn't squeeze it any tighter. Don't know how to express it in any other way. Couldn't squeeze it any tighter.
Because she'd taken it to its most dense...
took it to its most dense state
format
in which it was still living.
Uh-huh.
But there was more densification to happen. And so the result was, and what I'm going to tell you now is incomprehensible. It's comprehensible and incomprehensible at the same time. Try to conceive how something that is totally and purely alive and organic could turn into something inorganic. This is what happened to her at this final point when she had formed the planetary body all except for the core of the Earth. And in the core of the Earth, where there was the remainder of a ball, of a sphere, of her pure, white, opalescent, living, self-conscious, organic light, and it turned into an organic substance, which is lemon quartz. And so, the surreal truth that I propose to you is that at the core of this Earth, there is a geode composed of lemon quartz.
At the very core.
At the very core, right.
Okay.
And at the center of the Earth, right. And that geode, you know what a geode is? You've all seen them.
Right.
They're kind of spherical. When you crack them open, you see the crystal quartz, and sometimes there's a hollow space inside the geode, right?
Yes.
We're coming to that. It formed a mass, a hollowed out mass of crystal quartz. Now, this is a horrifying experience for the Divine Sophia and something that she could not reckon. It's as if, imagine that you, an ordinary person walking around, and you don't know what glass is, okay? You've never seen glass. And suddenly your hands turn to glass. And you can't use them. You can't pick up anything with them. You can't move your fingers. You're looking down, and your hands have turned to glass, and you don't even know what glass is. Can you imagine the horror of that experience?
Yeah, yeah.
This is what happened to her. And that was the moment of her ultimate terror. And she remembered that moment in January of 2012. I told you when we started this experiment that the task of the Nahual is to track her divine recall, and that I could only remember what she underwent in the real time.
In real time.
Remembering.
Yeah, I was trying to press you on that in about August of last year, and you said that you couldn't do it until it came up in real time with her.
Came up in real time around...
In the middle of January.
That's right, and I knew
that. Accompanied by these sounds.
And I knew that because I can track it, the timing, from the apogee positions in the constellations. Okay, this is all verifiable, folks. You can do as I do. You want to learn how to do this? It's a fantastic thrill to do this. Believe me, It is a beautiful discipline, and you can learn it. It's learnable. I'm not telling you anything that you can't find out through your own capacities, if you so deem it so, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, when she experienced the terror, and it was terror and fear, was an emotion that she didn't know. And because, listen very closely to what I'm going to say now, she still had her anoia operating, that is, projective intention, and she still had her epinoia, because the aeons have epinoia. They produce everything out of epinoia, which is imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So her imagination, the power of imagination, and her power of intention were not snubbed out. They were still operating at the moment that this ultimate precipitation of organic light into lemon quartz happened. And because those faculties were still awake, and because she could not reckon the emotion of fear and terror, she produced a phantom of terror in her own mind. That was the only way that she could reckon with this event. Her own imagination produced a phantom entity of terror as her way to realize what had happened to her and to reckon with this momentous shock.
So, John, are you saying in a sense it's her way of intellectually coming to terms with it, and it's something to how she can...
No, it's not intellectual. It's not intellectual.
Well, right.
It's as if you were sitting in your living room and suddenly you heard an enormous rumbling in the hillside, and you feel the house shaking, and you don't know what it is, and you think, oh, it sounds like a freight train coming down the hill, or it sounds like a mammoth elephant, 40 times bigger than any elephant, is running toward my house, okay? Because you cannot reckon intellectually what it actually is, and because the fear is overwhelming, you make it into an image.
Okay, yeah.
She produced an image, okay?
Uh-huh.
To explain to her the terror that she was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But because she is an aeon, she can't just produce an image, Thomas. You and I can sit here, and I can sit here and imagine, you know, a mongoose dressed in a pinstripe suit sitting on my terrace.
Sure.
But I can't make that mongoose appear, can I?
No.
But she can't not make it appear.
Huh, okay. I see what you're saying.
Anything she imagines appears.
Okay, got it.
So there appeared, at that moment, in the hollow space of the hollowed-out globe of yellow quartz at the center of the earth, a creature.
Okay.
Creature of
okay.
Terror.
Do you want to give the name there?
Mantis. It's a mantis.
Mm-hmm.
There is a giant mantis entrapped in a lemon quartz geode at the center of the earth. Now, this mantis is a real creature. I know, because I've seen it. I have been in the presence of this mantis.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 40 years ago in L.A., in around 1978, okay?
Yes.
And it was a lucid dream, but it was a bilocation dream. Have you ever had one of those, baby?
Uh-huh.
It's when you know you're in two places at once.
Yeah.
So I knew that I was sleeping in my little bed on Sycamore Avenue in the Hollywood Hills, but I also knew that I was simultaneously bilocated to the center of the earth. And there I stood inside a grotto formed of the massive lemon crystal with beautiful green ripples through it. And in front of me, there stood, or there sat actually, on a kind of throne, an enormous mantis, probably 40 feet tall if it was stretched out. Alive.
Mm-hmm.
but not organic. The manises that we see on this planet are very, very special animals. And every time you see a manis, you want to pay attention to it and connect with it. Because the manises that we see on this planet, the praying manises, are actually copies in organic reproductions of an inorganic model. Now, this manis is a very special creature. And if we may continue, I have about 10 more minutes now. If we may continue, take this at a good pace, because I realize that this is a lot to take in. If we may continue, I'll talk more in detail about this manis in the next talk.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But I want
Absolutely.
To bring, I want to bring this vision. I'm going to just leave you with this vision. By the way, it's absolutely gorgeous. I was stunned by the beauty of this manis.
Okay, can you just mention the eyes and the color and the shape of the eyes?
I'm not going to tell you about the eyes until next
okay.
time.
Okay, all right.
Because that's a
okay.
special detail. But I will say that it has the flat face of a manis about the size of a squashed Volkswagen Beetle. You know, car.
Uh-huh.
It is of the most exquisitely, it's not lime green, I don't know how to describe it, of the most exquisitely, perfectly green. You know, lemon quartz is clear quartz tinged with a lemon color.
Mm-hmm.
But this is pure lemon color, this mantis. It is pure quartz saturated with this beautiful amber yellow color of a dull radiance, and the elegance and beauty of its limbs and of its form is absolutely magnificent. It is a magnificent creature. So, I want to bring now, I want to leave you with that image in the context of Sophia's story, and I want to advise you that you can only understand this manis in her story, just as I told it, okay? Keep it in her mm-hmm. story. I want to tell you how this relates to what we're experiencing now. The real significance of these sounds is, as I just described, the waking up in the throes of the planetary animal mother in her nightmare, or to use another metaphor, the racking of the bulkheads and the wind in the sails of the mother ship as she undertakes self-navigation. These are absolutely real events described in a metaphorical fashion. Mm-hmm. And people are verifying them every single day. That's the real significance. The surreal significance, something a little bit more sinister. This mantis has only one desire, and that is to get out.
To get out of the prison.
Get out. It mm-hmm. really wants out. And it's starving. And, you know, they eat their mates while they're copulating with them. You know, they're famous for this, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this is a female manis, and she really wants to mate, and she wants to consume an enormous number of male manises. And she is in a frenzy to get out and do that. And Sophia has something in her way. She has to get this mantis out before she can give her full attention to correction.
Hmm.
Can you see that?
I can. Do you mean out? Out means
out
literally
the center
out
of the earth.
So she wants that too.
She has to get it out because terror also stands in her way, my friends. This giant mantis is the residual image of her terror, which is an emotion that an Aeon is not even supposed to feel. And unless she gets her terror out of the way, just like we have to get the terror out of our way, don't we? Mm-hmm. To get the terror out of our way to have a life worth living on this planet, just get along with each other on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Her situation is the same as ours, although it's supernatural and surreal. She has to get this mantis out. And the question is, how does she get it out without splitting the earth open?
Mm. Yeah. It's quite a predicament.
That is her predicament. That is exactly her predicament. And currently, there is an emission of sound coming from the core of the Earth. And recently, a Soviet scientist even predicated this. Did you see that? I ought to send a link around to the crew.
Please.
The first person who has explained that the origin of these sounds might be due to something that is happening at the core of the Earth. If you want scientific validation, I can give it to you. It already exists. As the mantis gets frantic, and as it gets hungry, it does something that all mantises do. It sends out ultrasound screaming. It screams. Mantises scream. They scream with ELF and ultrasound waves. That's how they communicate. We know that most insects communicate that way, don't they? And so to some degree, the shock that is coming upon us, the shock that is coming toward us, is the benevolent shock of the shockwave of Kali and of Sophia herself, the shock of her love, the shock of her embrace coming to us. We are going to be interactive with this entire planet on a journey that never ends. But there's a problem, because there is an interference into this shock wave. At the same time that we are being reached by the shock wave, we are being reached by these sinister ELF screechings of the mantis. And that can do two things. It can drive an ordinary person pretty wacko. But it can drive the psychopaths right over the top. Because there's a reason, which I will explain in the next talk, of why psychopaths are wired to respond violently to these particular screechings.
Huh. Okay. That's fascinating.
There's a very specific reason why it would be exciting the psychopaths. The psychopaths are like these Israeli Zionist warmongers, just to name a few. It's the easiest label to put on them, of course, but that's just another mask. They are like rabid Dobermans in a pit. They are salivating to take the whole world into mass violence and insanity. And they are being susceptible to being extremely agitated by the screeching and the mating call that comes from mantis. We call it mantis. We don't call it the mantis or a mantis. That comes from mantis. And we know who mantis is now, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. So,
now,
John,
why am I getting, am I reading too much into this, that I'm getting in my mental image here in my head is connections into 911 and into the work of Dr. Wood and free energy?
No, that fits right in here.
Am I reading too much? Okay.
That fits right in here. You could say that the people are using directed energy weapons are tapping this mantis power and using it recklessly. Yeah.
With crystals.
That's right.
Okay.
You're right on track, as usual. Finally, I want to say that the carnal embrace of the Anthropos is extremely important now, because when you lay in and reticulate new layers on your myelin sheath, it not only allows your nervous system to receive the benign and benevolent and pleasure-filled wave of shock coming from Sophia, but it also allows you to handle these ELF waves and not be deranged by them and driven into mental breakdown. That is the purpose of lying in each other's arms. It's the refuge we have. And you know, if push comes to shove and the whole world goes under, that's also where we're all going to end up anyway.
Sure.
Lying in each other's arms when the cloud comes over. Come on, let's face it. May as well get in each other's arms now. And do it for an occult reason, you know, for an occult reason that you understand. Okay. Right.
Well, it's been 2 days since you first brought that out on Monday. And so I've gone through two of these carnal embraces with my lovely wife. And I must tell you that they're two of the most intimate, wonderful, beautiful experiences of my entire life. And I believe that she will verify that in her own words as well, if she ever had the chance. Absolutely wonderful.
Thank you, Thomas, for disclosing that. And I can tell you and everyone who's listening that when we lie in each other's arms now without the sexual agenda, although we don't have to exclude that, as I explained, mm-hmm. primarily knowing that it is for refuge, we lie in each other's arms in the carnal embrace of the Anthropos. And this is not like any other embrace that we've ever had. This is the refuge of Kala Tantra.
Yeah, refuge, it's a good word. It was a safe haven, just absolutely beautiful.
This is not only how we have safety, but we build safety. Because when you lie in that embrace, when you perform that rite, you optimize the layering, the reticulation of myelin that the Sophia herself is now accomplishing in every single human being on the planet. Mutate us to the next life with her. The next life with her.
Well, John, I think with that beautiful statement, that is a good place to roll things up for today. And
yes.
I look forward to hearing more about this same thread here in a few days.
We are going to keep pace, aren't we? And say Monday we'll go right to it again.
Sure. Okay, let's just pencil it in as Monday at this point.
We'll do.
Fantastic, John. Thank you very much for today again, and I'll talk to you in a few days.